Today is Wednesday, July 27th, 2022. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history with Tersh Baker. Tersh's name is spelled T-E-R-S-H. Last name is B-A-K-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Tersh. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, Tom. And yourself?
Very good, thank you. Tersh, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, sir, you certainly may.
Thank you very much. We ended part three in about, 1978, when you were the vice president of exploration for Hahn Brothers Oil and Gas. And I was curious what made you leave them and go out on your own.
Well, I guess I just have always had an entrepreneurial bent, and kind of like my dad in a way. He didn't like working for other people, and like my youngest daughter, who does not like working for other people and would prefer to strike out on her own. And I had a friend of mine here in Corpus who approached me and asked if we wanted to do business together, and he was the basically the financial end of things, where he had a little office building, and so we renovated that and started a little company called Baker Allen, and we did some good things, but you know, capital is hard to come by in the oil and gas business. Well, it wasn't back then, because banks would still loan you money for operations. But it's a very intensive capital business. It costs a lot of money. And, you know, you're dealing with someone that's somewhat infinite or unfinite, I guess would be the correct word, until it comes to the surface, then it becomes finite, and then it's cashable, and you have cash flow, and you go on down the road.
Okay.
But there was a very famous geologist by the name of Walter Platt, P-L-A-T-T, who back in the 1920s, was one of the first truly geologists that worked in the oil and gas business, and at that time, he had worked for Humble Oil and Gas Company, or just Humble Oil Company, really, is what it was called, the precursor to Exxon and Exxon Mobil. And Ms. Pratt said something very, very significant, at least it was to me, and I think it probably is to the rest of the industry, and when saying that oil is found in the minds of men. It's not found any other way, and the minds of the men means that you have to know where it's hiding,
right?
And then you go hunt for it. And previous to the 1920s, the majority of your exploration was back in the east, in Pennsylvania and West Virginia, places like that, where you had outcrops that you could follow, and you had a lot of seeps that would come out of the outcrops or, you know, in pastures and whatever. And, you know, they would have creekology, closeology, but there was not really any geology until basically the 1920s. And that's the way you look at things, subsea, subsurface. And that's where the creative aspect comes in. Excuse me, you know, what is under there, and where is the trap, where is the seal, and, you know, could something have migrated up there to be, you know, trapped? And a great example of this is what ExxonMobil, Hess Oil Company, and a couple other people in the same consortium had been doing down off of Guyana in South America. And they're finding tremendous fields down there.
Okay.
And have been, excuse me, Tom, I've got something caught in my throat, but I've I've been doing this for the last couple of years, at least as far as drilling wells, they found 26 new discoveries down there with trillions of cubic feet of gas, billions of barrels of oil, and it was all done by seismic.
Huh.
And, you know, that's a process by which you use basically sound waves to go down and bounce among the various stratas down there and capture it when it comes back up. It's like a sonogram.
Right.
It's exactly like when a doctor, you go to a facility and they give you a CAT scan, sonogram, all that kind of stuff. That's exactly what it is. It's non-invasive techniques.
Yeah.
But what it takes is the mind of someone to say, you know, or think, hey, there might be something there. Shall we take a look at it?
So for somebody who does not know oil and gas at all, I would think that by 1978, and I'm really naive at this, clearly I was wrong thinking about it, I think by 1978 in Texas, that hunting for oil would have been all hunted out.
No, and the reason why, and as a perfect example, there is now a very active search in down here in our part of the country in South Texas for a formation called the Eagleford, E-A-G-L-E, capital F-O-R-D. And basically, it's a shale, and nobody, of course, had ever drilled shale down here.
Okay.
That was something you drilled through to go to somewhere else.
Right.
Nobody ever paid attention to it until some smart guy started thinking. And matter of fact, one of the smart guys is a guy by the name of Greg Robertson, who's a good friend of mine. And basically, that particular formation that nobody paid attention to until 2009 was the source rock for other formations. So, you know, when you have geology, you have to have a source. The source is usually going to be a shale, and then when you have enough heat and you have enough temperature and enough pressure on top of the shale, then you squeeze out, basically that's the formation of hydrocarbons.
Okay.
Because the hydrocarbons are trapped in the shale. You know, old trees, dead dinosaurs, whatever.
Right.
You know, the stuff that comes down the rivers. Hopefully not what's coming into your house, but
exactly.
You know what I'm saying. And so we, you know, the industry did not look at it. Back in the 20s and 30s, they were still drilling very shallow wells, 2,000-foot wells. They were in sandstone. They were coming in at 100, 200, 300 barrels a day, and that's great. But then, as, again, this gets back to the mind element, good geologists will sit and look, say, okay, here's this. What else is down there?
Hmm.
And so this gets back to Wallace Pratt's theory that oil is found in the minds of men.
Hmm.
And it's the oldest, you know, thing. You have maybe 20% are leaders and everybody else is a follower.
Right.
And the oil and gas industry, because of the huge capital expense, excuse me, that's associated with it. I'm sorry, Tom.
No worries. Do you want to go get a drink of water?
No, I've got some water here.
Okay.
You know, it's a good percentage of the industry is a follower. Because, you know, you want to look at what has gone before and then build off of that and say, okay, if it's good over here, I think I can find something over here and whatever, and that trips your mind working. But the true explorationist is someone that says, okay, well, you know, you got it here, you got it there, but let's look at something else. And there's always been something in your mind back when you're in geology school or wherever, working for another company, a major, that kind of tickled your imagination. And, You know, that's what tickled mine back in the day, back in the 80s. So, you know, long story short, you know, its expiration is found in the minds of men.
So you were mentioning...
How you interpret things that might be 15,000 feet below the surface.
Okay. Is that where Robertson went for the Eagleford Shale? Did he just go super deep?
No, but he looked at a formation that had been bypassed.
Okay.
And probably in the bypassing, there were indications that formation should have hydrocarbons in it. For instance, the formation above it has long been a productive formation in Texas.
Okay.
What fed that? What sourced that formation? Well,
right.
Where's the nearest shale? Well, the nearest shale's about 50. Matter of fact, it's contiguous with it. It's the next formation below. The one that had been around since the 1930s.
That had been drilled and was yielding oil.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was a big formation, and a lot had to do with the techniques of, because you had to crack the rock, because shale inherently has got a lot of porosity, a lot of storage space, but it doesn't have very much, if any, conductivity. In other words, you got a lot of porosity, but you don't have any permeability. So part of the puzzle was, and there was another formation called the Barnett, which is up by Fort Worth, and that people had been puzzling over and over and over, and they finally unlocked it. And the reason, or how they unlocked it, was how they would, you know, create permeability to let the oil and gas that was stored in the various components flow to the wellbore.
Is that fracking? Is that where fracking comes in here?
That's
okay.
Exactly what that is. It's fracking. And there are so many different ways to frack, and so, you know, and today you can drill a well for, you know, let's say 7,000 feet below the surface and go out about 7,500 feet in the pay zone. You can go ahead and drill all that for $2 or $3 million, but it costs you $4 or $5 million to frack and complete the well, you know, run pipe, frack it, and all that. And that's where the industry is in the last 15 years has really come on strong, is the different completion and the frack techniques. Everybody knows it's there, commercial people, not commercial, but the finance people love it because it's a repeatable function. And so you come up with the concept of manufacturing. They call it, well, we're just going to manufacture this well. Well, geologically, that doesn't really work, because there are good spots and there are bad spots, and you just hope that you can identify a sweet spot to get into and make much better wells than you do in the not-so-good spots. And that's part of the reservoir engineering aspect of it, and also part of the geology. And so you go ahead and you know, drill and capture cores, and you lay down the core barrel, and you cut it in half and slap it so that you can see exactly what those rocks look like.
Right.
And then you know what you're looking for.
And I would assume that with a small company like Baker Allen, if you're talking about possibly $9 to $10 million to bring in a well, if you're going to frack it out, that's an awful lot of capital you've got to pull together.
Exactly. And Baker Allen did not get into that.
Okay.
And unfortunately, my business partner had some medical issues that caused us to go ahead and part company.
Okay. What year was that?
1980.
And so what did you do then?
Well, put my prospecting hat on and started looking for oil and gas.
Okay, but your financial aspect of the deal I just left. How did you work out your finances? Because it sounds like you'd always been good about visualizing geology and thinking, well, this might be a good place to go to drill. So that makes sense that you would head out and do that yourself. But how did you handle the financial side of that?
Well, everybody in the oil and gas business, nobody drills a well heads up. You know, it's the old concept of OPM, other people's money.
Okay.
And what you do is you go and you finance your operation of whatever you want to do and find backers, whether they're private equity, whether they're public equity, whether they're, private individuals, whether usually back in the 1980s, you did it with other companies, like I did my deals with Texas Eastern.
Okay.
For the majority of the 80s, as a matter of fact, I have found the largest producing field by volume that Texas Eastern had in the lower 48 United States. Now, that doesn't count the offshore stuff out there in Santa Barbara in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But in the lower 48 United States, I've found the, in partnership with them, the largest by volume, production volume, field in the continental U.S.
Wow.
But you can't do it all yourself.
Right.
I mean, unless you're born rich, you inherit rich, or something happens.
Right.
But
I mean, you've got to have the funds, and you've got to have the smarts, and you've got to put it all
right
together, and that's going to be a rare day.
That's exactly right. So that's what happened in the 1980s, that I met some people, and I've forgotten where I met them, but they were up in Tyler, Texas, and so I started doing some stuff with them. And we found some wells. In fact, some of those wells are still producing. And then just, you know, kind of one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how it happened.
Are you still in the business?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Still am. And still have the same company, Baker Petroleum Company, Inc., that I formed back in 1980.
Nice.
And so, yeah, it is. It really is. Of course, capital is so much harder to come by now than it was back then. Back then, banks would loan you. They were really good about loaning money to you if you knew them and if you had demonstrated past success in business.
Right.
Just like anything else.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, when the shale revolution came along and Eagle Ford, you know, this, that, and the other kind of thing, which cost so much money to drill and complete a well. I mean, when I was drilling and completing a well, it would cost maybe $500,000 to drill and then maybe $200,000 or $300,000 to complete.
Wow, not much.
And not much, no. You could almost afford that yourself. You'd get a couple partners, a couple buds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, let's go drill this. Well, okay, what's it going to cost me? Well, I'll take 10%. Well, another one's I'll take a quarter, blah, 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 and then you operate the well. Drill it, hopefully find something.
Mm-hmm.
But compare that now to a well drilled at the same depth, but you're going horizontal and you're fracking the damn thing. And you're talking about $7 or $8 million. Now you can't do that with your buds,
right?
You know, unless your buds are pretty damn wealthy.
So the difference is,
so,
you know, you were drilling straight down for
exactly
less than $1 million, versus the fracking, which is you go out this way and you go out that way and you sort of fan out from one drill pad.
Right.
That's a ton of drilling. So
it makes
sense why it's $7 to $8 million.
Per well.
Per well, yeah.
So you have a five-well pad, you're looking at $35
million. Wow. Okay.
And that's why it's a big boys game.
Right, and you have to get I mean, it has to pay in. It has to come in with enough energy to pay itself off. That's a lot.
And that's when I talked earlier about sweet spots and not so sweet spots, and that's all because of inherent permeability. And also a lot to do with the amount of clay that might be in the formation. I mean, I don't know whether you ever went to geology school, but you have montmorillonite, illite, you know, blah, 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 four different types of clay. And when you put water on them, if you're not careful when you're drilling, those clays swell.
Right.
What they do is they plug up the pore space that's contributing to flowing to the wellbore. And once that, you know, I went to Halliburton Engineering School up in Oklahoma and took a 3 or 4 week course up there back in the day, back in the 80s, because I wanted to drill wells. And that contamination of water on clay is instantaneous and it is irreversible. You can never get back the original permeability out of those sands. Once it gets clobbered up, you know, with swelling clay. So those are all the variables that, you know, that go along with it. And that's why it was so much easier back in the day, back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, for independents to go out on their own. And basically what would happen is you know, everybody's got buds in this business, but the business is a very close fraternity of people. And particularly back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, in that period of time. And which means really everybody knows everybody else.
Right, right.
And that's one reason why you better damn well be honest. You better do what you say you're going to do. And
right.
Otherwise, nobody's going to, you know, do a deal with you.
Right. Their reputation, bad reputation, would travel really fast, I bet.
Sure. And I mean, it's not just local. It's countrywide. Because, again, the oil and gas business is a very close-knit business. And you know people in West Virginia. You know people in, you know, Louisiana and Mississippi and Alabama and New Mexico and wherever out in California. And, you know, if you're active, people know you, you know them. We have our associations, you know, Texas Independent Royalty Owners Association and you know, Operators Association, Texas Oil and Gas, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, those are all trade associations. And I, you know, used to go, I haven't lately. Used to go to, you know, two or three different association meetings, and, you know, work with them, be on committees with them, and,
right,
you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's just a very interesting business, and I just do love it.
Nice. During the 1980s, where were your mom and dad living?
My mother and dad were divorced at that time.
Okay.
And my mother was in Tucson, Arizona, and my dad was in Georgia, because we had a fertilizer plant there in Augusta, where we made chemical fertilizer.
Okay.
I had a big fertilizer plant, and he had sold Bradley and Baker, which was our family company, to Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company to build a huge nitrogen plant in Augusta. And I don't know why they chose that site, but they did. And
I find that interesting that a company called Pittsburgh Plate Glass is in fertilizer.
Well, they were, and they were a big time entity in fertilizer.
Okay.
And, you know, particularly in nitrogen and that type of stuff. And, of course, to make nitrogen, you have to cut natural gas and separate it into its different components. And I think our plant, or what was PPG's plant then, used more nitrogen, you know, some saying that the wrong way. They used more natural gas in one day than the city of Augusta, which is probably about 80 to 100,000 people. And, you know, that's where they played the Masters.
Wow.
Did in a year.
Wow. Huh. And where was your mom living in Tucson?
You know, I don't remember her specific address, but she was working for IBM out there.
Okay.
And she had worked for IBM since the two of them got divorced, which was back in, late 1960s, I guess.
Okay.
But, you know, she was a Grand Canyon girl, and she had the opportunity to go out to southern Arizona and Tucson and, you know, basically get back to her roots. Her mother was still alive, my grandmother and grandfather were still alive at that time.
Right.
And they were living somewhere in the Phoenix area.
Okay. Did you have any, I mean, who had, Barbara wasn't out there, so were your grandparents on their own out there, Phoenix?
Yeah, I guess so. And I think what happened was, and I'm not too sure about this because I was in college at the time, is my grandmother died, and she died up at the canyon. And I think that's why she was buried in the old settler's cemetery there.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandfather, you know, succeeded her, and he went down south in the Phoenix Scottsdale area.
Okay.
But, you know, my mother felt very close to that part of the world.
Mm.
And when she and my dad divorced, that's where she went.
Would she go back and visit the canyon like once a year or so? Do you know how often she got back?
Probably.
Okay.
Probably. I know she went up there one time and took met Ronnie and Stephen up there, I think. And they went out to visit, you know, one of the Hopi families out on First or Second Mesa. I've forgotten which one.
Okay.
And, yeah, I mean, she would keep in contact with the Verkamp family. And, that was her home. That's where she grew up.
And what did she do for IBM?
You know, I've forgotten, and
okay.
I probably couldn't even tell you. I mean, I can't remember what it was. I don't remember what she did, but she was, I've forgotten who ran the company then. Anyway, she did something in probably middle to upper management. I forgot what it was.
Okay.
Now, I don't know what they had in Tucson, whether that was the local Arizona base or whether that was, you know, I just didn't follow it that much. I was in college and playing ball and,
right.
You know, I had my own stuff to think about.
Right. I mean, Hughes aircraft was out there in Tucson. There were a number of you know, certainly Davis-Monthan and the Air Force Base, a lot of aircraft mm-hmm. stuff out there.
Right. I remember seeing all of that.
But, Yeah, growing up in Tucson, and I'm drawing a blank now when I think about IBM in Tucson. I'm like, okay.
I have no idea what they did, but she was out there working for them.
Okay.
And, that, you know, that's all I know.
And so 1990s, you're working oil. Your brother and sister, Steve and Ronnie, are... Is Ronnie I'm thinking of the town. She's in Nevada.
No, at that time, I believe she was in Colorado.
Oh, okay.
Because she went to either CSU, I think it was Colorado State, and got a nursing degree.
Oh, okay.
And she was a registered nurse. And she and her husband spent a fair amount of time, and I can't call how much, but quite a bit of time there in Colorado in terms of years in her nursing career. And then she got tired of that, and they got in the bakery business of
really?
All things.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, she's in Reno now. That's right.
Right. And then they moved from Colorado up to Reno to start another restaurant business where they owned a couple of really good pizza parlors.
Okay.
And they kept that for, hell, 20, 30 years until she and Fred decided to retire. I guess it was just about last year, maybe a year before that. I think it was right before the COVID, so that would have been a couple of years ago.
Okay. And if they're into a bakery and they start a pizza business, they must know pizza crust pretty well.
My sister was big on that. I mean, that poor dear, she would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, they did because they were the bakery business they were in was in a... in a mall, Cinnabon.
Okay.
And she had to show up there at 3 o'clock in the morning, prepare everything.
Yeah.
You know, blah blah blah. And then she wound up doing the same damn thing in their pizza business. But it was highly successful there in Reno.
Oh, good for them.
And I was glad to be able to go there and see how it worked. Before they decided they'd had enough and they wanted to retire.
Yeah, I mean that's something you're wedded to.
It was just unbelievable.
Oh, it's really a challenging work.
I mean, that 3 o'clock in the morning stuff doesn't sound good to me, and it didn't sound good to me.
Yeah,
prior to that,
it does if you like getting up early, but.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Tom. That's why I don't shoot ducks anymore. I prefer to look for quail. They, you know, kind of get up and move around a little bit. Uh-huh. You know, you're about there about 8 o'clock in the morning with the dogs.
Right.
You might find some quail that are up. Otherwise, they're still asleep.
Right. Right. Yeah. Different. And then Steve. Steve was in Colorado as well. Is that right?
No. Stephen was, when my mother moved to Tucson, Stephen had lived with her.
Okay.
And he moved to Billings, Montana.
Okay, sorry.
And he was in some sort of business there. And forgive me for not knowing, I was this. You know, everybody was doing their own thing at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moved to, I guess it was Alpine Village Lake Tahoe.
Okay.
And he had a running shoe franchise there.
Okay.
I forgot, you know, Fleet Feet. I guess that's what it was. He had a Fleet Feet store and got involved in all the, you know, soccer and, you know, the other things that you do with, you know, running shoes and everything like that.
Hmm.
And then he shut that down in the late 90s, maybe early 20s, and then he went, what happened to him after that? He and his wife parted. And I think after that, he had reacquainted himself with an old friend of his in Utah, outside of Salt Lake City. And so, you know, they married and then, you know, continued on. Now, his son, Matt, I think you remember Matt.
You bet, you bet.
On a little trip. Matt is still in that area, not Utah, but up in the Reno area, working for IBM.
Oh, okay. Huh. And is Matt from Steve's first wife or his second wife?
First wife.
Okay.
A high position, I believe.
Good for him.
With IBM.
Okay.
He's kind of a sharp guy. I like Matt a lot.
Yeah, it's good. He's a good kid.
I mean, that was one of the benefits, other than giving my mother a proper funeral, was and meeting you and the others that did the trek with us, was that got to see Matt and again, and he's a good guy.
And Matt got to spend some time with your daughter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. God, they became great friends.
Yeah.
Still are.
Good. Yeah. Did your mom tell you and Ronnie and Steve that she wanted her ashes to go on Shiva Temple? Did she express that to you before she passed away?
I do not know. She did not express it to me.
Okay.
She may have expressed it to Stephen or Ronnie or maybe both of them. No, she didn't. She didn't express anything like that to me at all. She and I had a difficult relationship because I was off by myself going to school at a boarding school when I was 14.
Right.
And, you know, every time I saw her, she would try to teach, you know, treat me like, well, I'm still at home and blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
And I just didn't like that. So, anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Right.
But I think Stephen came up with the idea because we had, had the her ashes, and Stephen kept them and he put them on his mantle. And I said, Stephen, what are you going to do with those? And he said, well, I don't know. Well, we'll think about something. Well, you know, after we had the funeral and everything like that and closed the house in Tucson down, about a year later, well, let's think about the trip that she made to Shiva Temple with Emory Cole, but blah, blah, blah. Would that not be a significant place to spread her ashes?
And that would have been maybe 2006 that she passed away?
I think it was, yes, summer of 2006.
Okay. So in August, I guess, don't hold me to the dates here. August of 2007, I guess Steve got in touch with Lee Albertson, the president of the Grand Canyon Historical Society. And asked for some assistance to help with this ceremony on the top of Shiva Temple.
Okay, I did not know that.
And Lee got in touch with a bunch of people and asked them if they wanted to participate in this, including Sally Underhill.
Right, I remember that name.
And myself, and a guy named Tom Myers, local doctor, strong Grand Canyon hiker like Sally, and Jim Ullman, and there were a couple of the Betty Levengood was...
I remember that name.
Betty was... she wrote a wonderful book about women at the Grand Canyon.
Right. Right, I've read that.
And she was a member of the Historical Society, and somehow, I think Lee put the word out to the Society that this event might happen and maybe people wanted to participate. And she said, yeah, I want to participate. And then Steve was like, well, maybe we can do this in late October of 2007. But the North Rim Lodge was closed by then.
Exactly.
So he said, well, how about in the spring of 2008? And we were all like, yeah, that could work. And the lodge opens and we could do it right after that. And I guess that first week of June came to be the date. And Sally had already thought about having to get water out there because it was like we could spend a day to hike out there and then to the rim and then a day to hike off the rim down to the Teal Point Shiva Temple Saddle and up to Shiva Temple and then back down to the saddle and then up to the top, which is like 1,200 foot gain and loss of elevation. You got to do that twice. In only 4 miles, it's not that far. But there was a lot of logistics that had to happen there.
Well, did y'all deposit water up on top of Shiva's temple?
No, but Hazel and I went out there a couple of days early, emailed back and forth, and we'd never met any of you. And we went out there a couple of days early. The road out to Teal Point was closed. Mm-hmm. And it was going to open in a couple of days, but like the day we were all going to hike in, it was going to open. And I had talked to the Park Service's superintendents, secretaries, and the backcountry people about this thing, and they were all supportive. There was a form, I think, Steve had to fill out for ash scattering.
Right.
And I think he did that. And so we walked from the Widfriss trailhead. Hazel and I walked out there with a bunch of water and dropped that off.
At the campsite?
Yeah, yeah, at the campsite on the rim. And that Hazel got a lot of blisters doing that, and she's like, "Well, I'm done."
Sorry.
Well, that's how you know it's what it is. You know, it just we had a good time, but you know, it was what it is. So the water was out there, and then we met you guys. Did we meet you at the North Rim Lodge the night before we were going to walk in there?
Yes, exactly.
And that was really helpful because when you get out there to Teal Point, it's pretty easy to get lost out there. And we didn't have GPS back in that time.
Right.
Just kind of walking on dead reckoning and following the road and then going overland to the south.
Right. Well, and there were also some trail signs.
Yes.
That somebody had stuck in ponderosa pine trees. They kind of gave us an idea of, well, which way we're going.
That's right.
But, of course, we all knew that you knew everywhere to go, Tom. So we just followed you.
Well, Jim was there.
You were the Pied Piper.
Well, I didn't know anything. Jim was there and Sally was there. And Betty was there with her son, Rodney.
Right. I remember him. He had the only phone that worked.
Right. He had a little cell phone. And
sure did.
Yep. And then you were there with your daughter.
Right.
What was her name again?
Brewer, B-R-E-W-E-R.
That's right. I was thinking Brooke, but I was like, no, that's not right. And Stephen was there with Matt. And Ronnie was there. And I think that was the crew.
No, that was the crew.
Sally and Jim. You and Brewer. Stephen and Matt and Ronnie.
Right.
Okay. And then, what do you recall of that hiking in?
It was a long way. And y'all gave me a lot of crap about my snake boots.
Tell me about those boots.
What you didn't understand, or what they didn't understand, was that I am totally allergic to the antivenom for snakes.
Oh.
And I know that y'all have got some mountain rattlesnakes in that part of the world, the black ones, and I wasn't going to take a chance.
Okay.
So those were my hunting boots, my snake boots that I wore, you know, bird hunting and wherever else I go, on leases and everything like that, because if I get bitten by a rattlesnake or a copperhead or whatever, you know, I just have to hold my breath and wait and see what happens.
Hmm. They looked to me to be manufactured. Those boots, just looking at them, they looked to be manufactured by a company called the Big Blister Boot Manufacturing Company.
No, they were manufactured. I have a bootmaker down in Raymondville.
Okay.
And they were made by him.
Okay.
And the uppers are Kevlar.
Okay.
And the lowers were a bullhide with some Kevlar in between. So, you know, most snakes are in the upper, you know, will strike you in the upper part of the calf.
Yeah.
But they don't get up to the knee.
Right.
Unless they're really mad at you. So, you know, I still hunt out of those boots.
Okay.
That's what those are for. And, you know, I'd had a pair of Gokies hunting boots made by the Gokie folks up in Minnesota that I was going to wear out there. But, I mean, they were about 12, 14 years old, and they just wouldn't fit. So I said, hell, I'll just take my old snake boots and go on. I was very comfortable with them.
Nice. Well, that,
I remember y'all gave me a hard time.
We did. We looked at those boots and thought, oh, my, that poor man. He's not going to be able to walk tomorrow.
No, I was pretty comfortable in them. I wear them all the time, so I was pretty used to them. I didn't have my little trail sneakers like my brother did, all that stuff.
Right, and I was really excited.
I was not a hiker.
Right. But it's not super hard. I mean, it's basically flat to get to the camp.
Right.
Gorgeous view there. Just gorgeous view.
Well, I know. That's where Burr and I wound up when we discovered, after we had gone down to get on the saddle to start going up to Shiva's temple, that Burr could climb up, but she could not.
Right.
Up or down, I've forgotten which way.
Within the first 20 minutes, the next day, so we spent the night out there, and that was a fine, nice, starry night.
Right.
And the next day, this is like early June. It's like monsoons are not going to happen.
June 6th, I think it was.
Yeah, 5th or 6th, something like that.
Right.
And it was a glorious sunny day. We got up early and had breakfast, and then kind of got all together and said, oh, well, let's go, and just tipped off the edge there and dropped on down. There was a nice little gully to shoot down, and I zipped on down there, and I was really excited to get a chance to spend some time with Jim and Sally that I knew of by reputation and by name. We'd been to some presentations together, and so I was excited to be spending the day with them, and didn't know you guys at all. And right away, it's like, whoa, hold up. And Brewer's like, I cannot do this.
No, she was just ice cold and totally white.
Yeah.
She could climb up, but she could not go down. And that was, you know, and I've heard of people like that before. And that was, you know, that's...
Did she know that already, or did that come on her like a 2x4?
No,
you know,
just like a thunderclap.
Wow.
She had not ever experienced that before, and I mean, she was just white. And so I said, okay, well, I couldn't let her sit up there at the rim by herself all day.
Right.
So I said, okay, well, Brew, let's climb on back up, and we'll, you know, take care of business up here and wait for everybody to do their thing and then come on back.
So we all agreed to that, and you guys turned around and we kept going. So we lost you right away. And then on the way down to the saddle, Betty was like, you know, I don't think I can do this. And
yeah,
so
I remember she came back.
She said to Rodney, you keep going, I'll be okay. So she turned around and headed back.
Right.
And when did she get back to the rim with you?
Well, I don't remember the hour, but I remember her coming back.
Like noonish, maybe?
Yeah, something like that. That sounds about right. I remember her coming back, and then we, you know, congregated and, you know, decided, you know, whatever. Had good visits and everything like that, and just waited for everybody else.
Right.
And then what did Ronnie did not come back by herself, but she waited, did she not, at a certain point in the trek?
So we all got down to the saddle, and that was fine. So that's Sally and Jim, and Stephen and Matthew and Ronnie and Rodney. Betty's son.
Right.
And that was fine. And then we went across the saddle and started up Shiva. And it gets steep pretty fast. And Ronnie was like, you know, I can't do this. It's too steep. And so you guys go ahead and I'll wait for you down at the saddle when you come back. And I think Rodney said he would go with Ronnie and stay with her there. So now
it's good. I appreciate him having done that.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
My sister.
Yeah. So they went, they were going to go back to the saddle. So now that left Stephen and Matthew and Sally and Jim and I.
Right.
And so we went up, you go up to the bottom of the Coconino, and there's a break that we're on the east side, and the break goes back toward the north up and back a little bit, and it was pretty easy to get through, a little bit of scrambling, you know, just really, really fun, sort of little climbing and whatnot. We had a rope, but I don't think we needed it. We got to the top of the Coconino, kind of tired, rested there for a while, and then worked around to the north side of Shiva and up through the Kaibab and Toroweep. But on the north side, where there's wonderful big spruce trees and just a lot of vegetation and kind of damp and really nice climbing in the summer. Just really enjoyable. And Stephen was a little tired, but Matt was just a tank. He was just going great guns, and Jim and Sally were doing fine.
Big old boy.
Yeah, just strong guy. But Stephen was doing pretty good. Anyway, we got to the top, and then right away you go from the north side to the flat top of this thing back in the pinyon juniper. It was dry up there and hot. And then we crossed over. We were on the far east side. It didn't take long to cross over to the south side. And Stephen had brought a camera, digital camera, or not, some sort of film camera, and a burlap bag to put on an agave stalk, which we found fairly quickly. And it was clouding over by then. It was getting a little cloudy, and that was unusual because the weather forecast was not about that at all. but we didn't pay much attention. But it was gorgeous. Isis Temple right off to the east, and then the South Rim developed area right across the canyon, and a totally different view than anything I'd seen. Really pretty. And then Ronnie had been carrying your mom, and she handed your mom over to Steve, and Steve was carrying your mom, and you know, it was emotional.
Before he made the assault up.
Well, did he pass her off to Matt?
I don't know, but if Ronnie was waiting down in the saddle.
Well, no, she passed.
She must have climbed with y'all to a certain part because she was in those kettles replicating what my mother and whoever the other woman was who climbed with her, right?
Right. Was that okay. Edith Cole,
I think? And I think that, yeah. But I think that was up on the temple, was it not?
Right. Well, she didn't. Ronnie didn't get that high. She didn't get to the bottom of the Coconino.
Okay. Well, where was those kettles?
They were at the very top. The milk cans, you mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, there were a couple of depressions in the rock up there.
Oh, the water.
And they laid down.
Yeah, that's way down at the saddle.
Like my mother.
Yeah, that was way down at the saddle. That's right.
Okay, all right.
That's right. So it was emotional. We got up there, and Stephen gave me the camera and said, "I want you to film this." And we had the flag, burlap, on the
right
agave, and then Steve just started into this incredible benediction, calling on the four elements of the four directions, and just on for, and just, it was amazing.
Really?
Yeah, it was just.
Almost like the Indians. So.
Absolutely. Just amazing. And Matt was standing with him. They were out on this little point, and Jim and Sally and I were standing back a bit. And it was just, we all started to cry. And then Steve just let her ashes go, and it was windy, and they kind of went everywhere. And it was just really, I thought it was very powerful.
Well, it sounds like it was, and I'm sorry that I wasn't up there with y'all.
Well, I think your brother,
leave my daughter alone.
Your brother did you proud.
Well, he did himself proud.
Yeah.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
And so then we spent a little time up there, but it was, you know, we had a long way to go to get back, and it was clouding up still more. And so we started down, got down through the Coconino pretty quickly, and then at the saddle picked up Ronnie and Rodney. And started going up. And right away, Ronnie was going pretty slow. So I remember I just took her by the hand and said, "We're just going to walk out of here, you and me, hand in hand.
Right.
And let everybody else go ahead. We don't matter. We'll get there." And Jim, before I left Jim looked at me and I looked at Jim. And I think he said, or maybe I said, "Hey, is that a snowflake?" And
then about 4 or 5 in the afternoon.
At that point, we're kind of all scattered out. Some people are going pretty well, pretty fast. Rodney's doing pretty good. Sally's doing good. Jim's doing good. I'm with Ronnie. We're going pretty slow. Matt's, of course, tanking along.
Yeah, she was kind of whooped out by that, I'm sure, by that time.
Yeah, and I never hike with a rain jacket or rain pants. Capital N, never.
Yeah.
But on that day, I was. And I had wrapped them around my waist and tied them off. And I don't know why I had gone with them, because it just wasn't supposed to be a day somehow.
That was an absolutely beautiful morning.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful day until really about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then all of a sudden the sky changed, the wind direction changed, and it came out of the north.
Okay.
and it started to gray up. And then around 4 o'clock, it started to rain. So I said, all right, Ronnie, Bert, we need to get things settled up in the camp and close things up and everything like that.
Right.
And then it rained, and then a little while later, it got cold, and it started to sleet. And then just about the time that y'all topped out over the rim, maybe in a little bit before that, it started to snow.
Right.
And so we just did the best we could to prepare the camp for y'all to come in, because we figured that, y'all were going through some pretty bad weather where you were coming up from, and, you needed to get warm and everything like that. But we did not have a stove or anything like that, so we couldn't create heat until either you came back or I forgot, maybe that other guy.
Rodney,
And
Jim Ullman, maybe, yeah.
Yeah,
Or Sally.
Was that the guy that just ran and hid his tent?
So what I've pieced together, Ronnie had a rain jacket, so she and I were in great shape. We were going slow, but we were steady. And we didn't care what was raining or snowing. We were just putzing along, and we were both very comfortable.
Right.
But we were late. Jim Ullman realized that he was going hypothermic before he got to camp, and so was Sally. And they both...
Sally was exactly right.
Yeah, they both got into their bivy sacks right away to try to keep their warmth, which was... not working real well.
Brewer got in there with either Ronnie and Sally or both of them.
Okay.
And exchanged body heat.
To try to get Sally.
To keep both of them going.
Right.
And that was the time when you and I talked and said, look, we're not going to be able to walk out of here.
Right.
We need to create a big fire.
Right. Well, before that, I had gotten my little stove going and was trying to make some hot drinks, but it was a one little blaster, little stove that could make one hot cup of something at a time. And that was going pretty slow. And Rodney had the little cell flip phone, so I opened it up and I called dispatch.
Right.
And I said, hey, we're out here. Things aren't going well. We've got a couple of people that are pretty hypothermic. And there was the same storm that hammered up us was breaking a little bit, but it had hammered the south rim too. And the SAR shift, the search and rescue SAR shift guy, was someone that I knew, but we weren't not on friendly terms. And I told him what was going on. He said, we can't fly. Good luck. But he told another guy who was working that day, who I did know and I was on very good terms with, and that guy started gearing up to cut their way into us with the fire crew off the north rim.
Oh, right. Well, that would have taken forever for them.
They figured they would get to us about midnight. And so that was going on. And then... you and I were talking there, and I realized, well, I've got fuel from my stove, which was liquid fuel. It's a regular white gas. And, things were wet, but there was lots of pine needles. And so we scraped up a bunch of pine needles.
We got the fire going and
poured that stuff on it, and woof, it took off.
Spent the rest of the night getting kindling to go into the fire.
And by within 5 or 10 minutes, we had a pretty good fire going and peeled those guys out of their bivy sacks and started rotating them in front of the fire.
Right. That's right. Well, I don't know whether Stephen got out of his sleeping bag or not. He just hit the sleeping bag and stayed in there, I think.
Right, but I think he was in good shape. I think he was responsive,
he was better than Ronnie.
Right.
And better than Sally.
and Jim.
And the two of them got in somebody's sleeping bag and used body warmth.
Right.
And Brewer did too. Brewer got in there somehow and used body warmth. Well, we got those three ladies, you know, in decent shape, and they came back. And eventually, as the fire kept going on and going on and going on, you know, we developed heat there. And then, you know, after about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, it wasn't that big a deal.
Right. Everybody was dried out.
Kept the heat. And that's right.
And I called dispatch back after about 30 minutes after we lit the fire, and I told them we had lit a fire, a warming fire, and I would call them again, which I did later, and told them we were stable. We hadn't been stable, but we were now stable. And then I would call them again in the morning. And I did that early in the morning.
And that's why I guess they met us down there at the trailhead.
Right. Now, Hazel, that afternoon, realized it was snowing. She was reading in the tent, and she opened up the tent, looked out, and there was snow everywhere. And she went, oh, my heavens.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And she stayed there.
And she realized that she could not find us. She couldn't help us, because what could she do? Yeah, she had a big propane tank and a stove, but she couldn't drag that stuff in there. So she stayed tight where she was. And next morning early, by then the road was open. She drove out to the trailhead where our cars were, and there were two rangers sitting in a patrol car with another patrol car there. They had driven out, and she said, you know, well, what are you doing here? And they said, well, we're waiting for those people that are hiking out. And she said, okay, well, I'm going to go hike in to meet them. And so she started walking in.
Right.
And
I remember
that. She met Betty first, and she was so surprised. And she said, oh, hi, Betty, how are you? And Betty said, fine. And so, how are you doing? Well, I'm the slowest, so I'm going ahead, said Betty.
Uh-huh.
And Hazel's like, well, if you're the slowest, where's everybody else? Something's not right.
Well, we were still walking through some snow.
Right.
You know, until we got out there. I mean, you know, you're up all night and everything like that, and it wasn't great. Actually, it was not. Actually, the hike out was really more enjoyable than the hike in.
It seemed very enjoyable. We were all alive. I was thrilled.
Look, the next day was a bluebird day.
Yeah.
It was warm.
Yeah.
All the snow was melting.
Melting out of the trees
and
falling.
And we had the rangers down there waiting for us at the trailhead. That was, I'll tell you what, Tom, that was something that, I'm not sure I enjoyed it at the time, but when you think back about it, you know, that was good. And I'm glad we all did it, and I'm so thankful that you were leading the parade.
I was not leading the parade at that point. Hazel left Betty. She ran into Rodney and you, she ran into everybody else, Brewer and Matt and Steven. And she was like, where are the rest of them? Now, hang on.
I'm talking about the night before.
Well,
when you all came back from Shiva, and you know, you and I talked, and okay, what do we need to do, and you know, get this, you know, save people and whatever. And I'm so very thankful and so appreciative of your leadership and what you did, basically to save us all.
Well,
I mean, there were a couple of people. My sister and Sally could have died there.
You're very kind. Rodney was Matt. You know, there
really
were
really appreciate.
There was a team of people in Brewer that were in good shape, and there was a team of people that weren't. So Hazel talks to you guys, and then she's like, well, all right, where's Sally, and where's Jim, and where's Tom? I don't see them anywhere. So she then goes a little further, and then she reaches us as we're coming along, totally shell-shocked that something like this could have happened to us. Just totally shell-shocked with our tails between our legs.
It's that part of the world, though. You know, when you're in the high desert, as you all know, things can change in a heartbeat. And, you know, it can go from 80 degrees down to 40 degrees down to whatever, you know, in a very short period of time.
Well, we were unprepared for that, and we were very we had been chastened by the Keepers of the Canyon, including Ruth Stevens Baker, that we needed to think about being a little more prepared than we had been.
I'll be honest with you. I was a little pissed off at Stephen because I said, you know, before he headed out there, and at least headed from here, me, and I said, all right, Stephen, what do we need? Oh, I'm taking care of everything. I got all the gear, blah, 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 blah. I said, okay, what kind of gear are we talking about? Well, you know, we're talking about sleeping bags. Stephen, do we need to take tents?
And I think we had told him he didn't need tents. Weather was going to be great. We don't need tents. Camping out in June on the rim? Come on, who needs a tent?
Yeah, you would not think that you would need them. But anyway, thank God for that one tent that Sally got into and Ronnie got into. And, you know, Brewer was helping them in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then thank God for your sterno or whatever it was that we, you know, lit the fires with.
Get that going.
And everything worked out okay.
So we got back. The Rangers were there. They saw us. They left. I sent an email to the director of the Park Service and the superintendent. I don't know who anybody I could think of, the North Rim District Ranger, whatever, the whole bunch of people. Backcountry people saying, you know, thank you very much. This has been an incredible honor and blah, blah, blah. And we got Ruth's ashes left up there and we almost died, but thank you for your assistance.
You think if we ever wanted to get permission to go out to that point again, that they would let us?
Oh, of course they would. Well, the park doesn't allow ash scattering anymore. So we
were the caboose on ash scattering.
Well, they just did that this year. So we did well there, but they're still open to going out and hiking out there and getting in trouble and having all kinds of adventures.
We can get to that one point again.
Oh, you bet. You betcha.
Well, that might be interesting.
It might be fun to go back.
I don't know.
When would we do that in 2028 as a reunion?
I don't think so, because probably 2028, I probably wouldn't be able to climb up anything at all.
Well, we could go out to the rim and spend the night out there just for old time's sake.
Wait,
and we could leave the tents at home.
but that's a good idea, Tom. We could go out to our campsite.
Yeah. We all made it out there and all go back.
Have a campsite reunion.
Of course, Betty's passed away now, but yeah.
Well, what about that older guy?
Rodney's, her son. Yeah.
No, not her son. I'm talking about the older guy who, as soon as he made the top of the rim, ran off and jumped into
his... Oh, Jim Ullman. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and was no longer.
Yeah, no, he's in good shape. He should be there, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that might be fun to do.
Well, we got 6 years to think about it.
Well, let's not think about it quite that long. You know, we might think about it next year. You know,
well, if we were smart,
we could think about it next year.
We could. Yeah, I was just thinking if Ruth passed away in 2006, we could do it in 2026. But anyway, we could do it whenever we wanted. So I don't know. You talk it up with Steve and Ronnie. If you get them, if you get their buy-in, I know Sally and Jim and I and Hazel would jump on it. So
would you?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's think about that because. You know, the North Rim has always been my favorite part of the canyon.
Hmm.
I mean, I just love the North Rim. There's something too, and always was, too touristy about the South Rim. And the North Rim, I just always loved. I love the vista and just everything about it. And, that'd be fun to do. Walk out there and spend the night. You know, have everybody have a glass of wine or something like that.
That would be lovely. And we wouldn't have to tram water out there if we just spent one night out there. That's a good idea. I like this. This is sounding better and better.
Go in there for one night and do that and come back in the morning. And maybe we'll bring, actually, probably get a couple camp cooks to come out there with us and cook a decent meal. In the evening and cook a decent breakfast in the morning and going back home.
Well, you guys talk it up.
I wonder if the Park Service has cleaned up the trail, the road that goes in there.
Oh, no, no, no.
Those big ponderosa pines that were laying across.
We would still have to climb over trees.
Okay. Well, you can't be a wimp.
That's right. So, slow and steady. It's all kind of flat.
Let's think about that, Tom.
It is at elevation, so you people down in flatland of Texas, you keep that in mind. It's a high elevation there, so.
Oh, I remember that.
Maybe some training. Maybe y'all need to go to Aspen for a little bit or something for a week or two to build up your hematocrit before you go over there.
Nah. Or you're going to come out there and say, let's, you know, hook them like we did the last time. But that would be great. I mean, seriously, you and I think about doing that. And, you know, I definitely do not want to lose contact with you.
No, not at all. That would be fun.
I think we might think about doing that for next year or something like that. If you have
I'm game.
Is let's do that, man. You know, figure out the logistics. We're not going to let my brother figure that out.
You know,
he's 0 for 1 right now.
You invite him and you say, look, I'm going to take care of the logistics and things will be a little different. Don't you worry about it.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, let's think about that. Let's talk about that. And actually ponder a little. I mean, I'd love to do that. That would be great. I know my daughter would love it. And
I bet Matt would like it. And,
I know he would.
I think Ronnie would enjoy
Matt
it.
Would, so. Stephen would, yep. Ronnie would. And, yep. You know, particularly since we don't need to. Now, I'm not talking about going down,
right.
You know, and then going
correct.
Up Shiva.
Correct.
I'm just talking about to our campsite there.
That's right.
And just, you know, enjoying that. And we would have a good evening there. We would, you know, get there in the afternoon, have a good evening there. Spend the night, and then, you know, appreciate the dawn as it comes up and look at Shiva's temple and Isis and everything else there. Then, you know, have breakfast, walk back, and, you know, as a celebration.
That sounds wonderful.
I think it would. All right, well, let's do that. I don't know who we need to permit or anything like that, and whether you did the permitting or Stephen did them, I don't know.
I think we did, but I think the Historical Society paid for it, actually, which was nice of them back in the day. That's 3 months in advance where you can get that permit, and during the weekday it should be pretty easy to get. In June and people have to travel and have to arrange all that, that would be fun. Think about that.
Well, let's do it, Tom.
Okay.
I'd really enjoy that. I'd certainly enjoy seeing you all again.
Yeah, that would be a lot of fun. That'd be great. And I'd love to. I'd bring out the tape recorder for that and just be great to get you all talking about your mom and things you remember. That would be fun.
Could I wear my boots?
Of course you can. Now that you've taught me all about them, I'd be stupid to say anything bad about them now.
Well, I'll tell you what, I didn't think of, you know, if one of those Rocky Mountain rattlesnakes that they have up there, those black and kind of silver ones, chewed on my shin or something like that, that would kind of been the end of the trip for me.
That's exactly right. We wouldn't want that to happen. So
no,
you bring those.
I wouldn't want it to happen. So anyway, let's do that. I mean, really, let's talk about it. I'm sure we could get Stephen to find the. Was he the one who arranged the permits, or are you the one who arranged the permits?
I think I did. It was just based on dates, and we kind of had a date in mind. But we had talked to the backcountry office before that, and they were very agreeable to make this happen, just given that, who Ruth was, and they were like, anything we can do to help, and they were very helpful with that. So.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's
nice.
Just keep talking.
Well, that sounds like a plan. Well, with that, we should probably conclude this oral history. What do you think?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't
like talking about myself all that much and everything, but you brought out a lot of old things, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. This has been a real enjoyable journey.
Let's stay in touch, and I will stay in touch with you and the gentleman up at Northern Arizona University.
Yeah.
On the Weed Foos painting.
That sounds good.
And he wants to talk with me and blah, blah, blah. So let's continue to do that, Tom. And I have really enjoyed our four conversations.
Yeah. Hang on, Terce. Don't hang up just yet. But let's go ahead and at this time we'll conclude part four of a Grand Canyon Oral History with Terce Baker. Today is Wednesday, July 27th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Terce, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Good night. I enjoyed every bit of it.